I think a lot of it goes back to your self-talk, and that's why I'm really big on like self-scripts, because our behavior is tied to our thoughts and our thoughts are tied to our language. So really, for me, the most concrete way to look at it is you have to monitor the way you talk to yourself. Because for most people, the shame cycle is actually not occurring by anybody else but you. Like that message that you got 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago is not actually being told to you anymore in many instances. It's an old wound that you are repeating to yourself, right? So that's why I believe that that self-script needs to be the thing that you say to yourself.
Today, we're going to talk about generational cycles and how we unconsciously pass them down from generation to generation to generation. And we're going to talk about how we break those cycles. Now, if you want to be a part of the conversation or submit your own questions or get coaching from me, then sign up to my Patreon. Enjoy the show.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my
Welcome to Mr. Chaz's Leadership, Parenting, and Teaching Podcast, where I introduce you to people who can help you on your leadership, parenting, or teaching journey. And today I have for you, this is going to be a treat. I'm super excited for this conversation. I have Dr. Anne Louise Lockhart with us today. I'm going to have her introduce herself, and then we're going to get right into the conversation. Go ahead.
Thanks, Jazz. So I'm Dr. Anne Louise Lockhart. I'm a pediatric psychologist, parent coach, and author, and a speaker. And I have been in private practice for 5 years in San Antonio, Texas. And I'm the owner of A New Day Pediatric Psychology. And I have a team of individuals who we do testing, we do therapy, we do parent coaching. So I've been here for 15 years. And before that, I had several years of training and experience working with the military as a civilian in a military hospital. So I'm a mom of two. I have an 8 and a 10-year-old, and I've been married for 22 years.
Wow. So much valuable, great experience that I hope that we can just absorb during this time. Today we are here to talk about breaking the cycle. It is a common phrase used, especially in my space. We're always talking about breaking cycles. So we're going to break it down with Dr. Anne Louise Lockhart. And we're just going to go ahead and get started. No more without further ado. So when people talk about, breaking the cycle, what would you say is, the cycle? Like, break that down for us. Like, what is this cycle that people are referring to, that I'm referring to?
So there's many ways to look at that, right? I mean, there's cycles tend to be things that we repeat, sometimes automatically, and many times out of habit and out of our conscious awareness. And so cycles could be anything that often we think of them as unhealthy. And because you're not saying, oh, I need to break the cycle of eating a salad every day. Like, we're not saying that, right? We're saying we're trying to break the cycle of unhealthy eating, or break the cycle of going to bed too late, or break the cycle of spanking my kids the way my parents spanked me, or about getting so angry and not being able to hold on to a relationship or a job. And we tend to get into these cycles where we repeat unhealthy patterns. And that's the bottom line, is that we repeat unhealthy patterns, whether it's within our conscious awareness or it's not. It's kind of like below the surface. And so once we're aware of that, we have to make a conscious effort to break the cycle of whatever isn't serving us. And many times we don't even realize we're engaging in that until we get into a meaningful relationship. So maybe it's a serious dating relationship, or a marriage, or kids. And like we were talking about before we started recording, is that many times you either think that you've dealt with your own issues, or once you start having kids, you're like, oh, snap, I guess I didn't deal with this. Because then whatever stage of life your kid is going through, it may be placing kind of a microscope on you and realizing that, oh, gosh, I didn't deal with this abandonment issue, or I didn't deal with this abuse issue, or I didn't deal with this not feeling good enough issue. Because then when your kid then struggles with it in school, getting poor grades, or can't make friends, or is being bullied, then they may trigger in you memories of things that hurt you. And now you're having to deal with it, which is why you're probably trying to fix things, or you get into like overprotective mode, or you overreact to a scenario that your kid does or talks about. And I think that's what the whole break in the cycle thing is that we can't do it unless we're aware that we're doing it. And I think that's the important thing. And one of the things that I post routinely, because it's such a powerful image, is on my Instagram, is there is a picture of Spider-Man holding back a bus full of, looks like zombies, just like a bunch of people in a bus. And then there's this kid walking by on his phone with headphones on. And the caption basically has, you know, family history, which is the bus full of, you know, people that are trying to get out. Spider-Man, it says you, and then the kid is your child. And it's really talking about how we try to hold back all of the toxic mess from our family history. And we're trying to protect this kid that we have that is totally oblivious that we're doing all this work. And that's what, to me, breaking the cycle is. That's why I love that image so much, because it's such a simple thing, but it's really simple image, but it's really hard work, because nobody wants to deal with stuff from their past, especially when it hurts. But if we don't, we're going to repeat it, and we're going to maintain the cycle, and it's going to continue to again, then get passed on to that child, who then passes it on to the next generation.
Yeah, that's really powerful. That visual is really powerful. And I'm imagining, you know, holding all the toxicity and programming from, you know, decades and decades of life, you know, so what do you do? Because you still, your instinct is to protect your child, right? From this oncoming bus, from the stress that you feel that you felt maybe throughout your life. And so, like, you know, and it comes from a good place. It comes from good intentions. But how do you actually, you know, how do you actually deal with that bus? Like, how do you do, what's the balance? How do you protect your child from that oncoming bus, but also, you know, allow them to continue living their life, not so, you know, consume or affect it by that oncoming bus that we're trying to affect them with?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't know if any of us have really figured that out, right? Mm-hmm. Because we want to protect our kids, but we don't want to get into the mode where we're snowplowing the path for them, where they never experience anything. Because we're so busy hovering and clearing the way that they never have any real life experiences. Your kid is going to get rejected and left out and heartbroken and failed for no reason and accused of something falsely by a teacher. Like that's going to happen. And if you're always so busy making sure that they are protected from all harm because maybe no one protected you, then that's not fair to them, because then they're not building a file system to know how to deal with things in the future. And so for me, I really believe that we know how to deal with things because we develop a filing system. It's what psychology calls like a schema, right? That we have a schema in our head that whenever we go through a situation, now we know how to do it. Like, you know, learning how to drive or learning how to cook a meal or learning how to interact with someone it's awkward, or someone, how to respond to someone who says something offensively to us, like, or how to respond to a bully. Like if we've never gone through it because someone is always going before us to take care of stuff, then we don't ever develop a filing system or a schema to know how to deal with it in the future. And so I think that we protect our kid from the oncoming bus of, you know, dysfunctional family systems, but at the same time, we don't want to protect them so much that they don't have any actual real life experiences. And that's such a hard balance, because you're like, so do I let my kid get hit by the bus? No, we don't let them do that. We provide a way of escape and provide a way for them to be aware. Maybe it's like, hey, sweetheart, when you cross the street, you got to take those headphones out and pay attention when you're crossing. Right. Yeah. So rather than holding it back, we help them to build awareness, situational awareness. As when I was working with the military, is we were constantly taught about situational awareness, is being aware of your surroundings, for example. So if that's something that we want to teach our kids, rather than doing it for them, we teach them how to do it. And helping them to process that heartbreak, helping them to process that unfair treatment, helping them to process that microaggressive or oppressive statement, like helping them to process that and then saying, well, what I should have done was, okay, well, what would that have looked like? Like, let's play it out. So mm-hmm. I say the offensive thing, or I say the inappropriate thing, or that person, you know, shoulder bumps you, whatever. What do you wish you would have said? Let's play it out. Mm-hmm. And you have them rehearse it. You have them talk it through and then rehearse it. So now they have this what if schema that they can generalize to other situations, so that should it happen again, they now know how to handle it rather than you fixing it behind the scenes. Yeah, yeah. Problem solving skills, exactly, and critical thinking. And really, individuals who, and they've shown it over and over again, is that kids who learn problem solving skills are more likely to be flexible and adaptable and more, and adjust better to life, have less tantrums, have less emotional and behavioral dysregulation, because they'd learn that there's not just one way to solve an issue or a problem. There's many different ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to practice problem solving, you have to have problems, right? And so if we right. are, right? So if we're trying to protect them from all the problems, then we're also, you know, taking away the opportunities and experiences that they have to learn how to navigate those problems. But that doesn't mean that we put our problems on children so that they have to, you know, figure out how to deal with us. It's about us being empathetic, allowing them to, you know, look, this is when you cross the street, you take your headphones off, you look both ways, you go through that teaching process preemptively, but you know, inevitably they're going to, you know, maybe not, they're, you know, they're gonna have the headphones in, they're gonna trip, they're gonna fall, they're gonna run into a pole. And then what, you know, your role is as the adult, as the parent, is to, you know, tend to their wounds, be like, look, I'm here for you. And then let's talk about the process, what happened, right? And so then the problem solving happens for next time. And then so next time they are a little bit more aware.
And you don't do it through humiliation and, you know, what you should have done was, and what's wrong with you? Why weren't you paying attention? Look at you now, banged up and bruised up. Didn't I tell you? And so we go through all of this stuff. And then thinking that that humiliation and that berating them and insulting them is going to teach them a lesson. And a lot of people do abide by that, right? Because a lot of our very traditional families, a lot of the black and brown families, a lot of Muslim families, a lot of Christian families, a lot of Asian families, a lot of families go through a lot of that stuff where this is what they were taught. And the way they learn is through feeling bad about your mistakes. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, yes, maybe it does humiliate you into not making the bad choice again. But is that what we're really trying to teach our kid, is, you know, learning through feeling bad about ourselves? And yeah, that's not what shame. I think is. Yeah, it's, shaming.
Yeah, shame. And, you know, children will internalize that and take that on as a part of them, mm-hmm. as opposed to a mistake that I made. Right. And that's where we want to look, like, yeah, it's okay for them to feel bad about a mistake, but not, you know, us put on. And you're so right. In a lot of cultures, you know, I think that we live just in a culture of shame kind of throughout the world. And I think in some cultures it's more prevalent than others, where it is, that is shame is the technique, is like, that is the parenting strategy. Make you feel bad about it so that you don't
do it again.
Right. Make you feel bad about yourself so that you don't do it again. And so that you live up to whatever those expectations are. But we know that that's not an emotionally healthy way to handle it, because they walk around with that shame for the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. And then also the other thing it does too, is that it pushes you away from the child. And then when those mistakes happen, those problems happen, they're not going to come to you, you know, for that guidance and those problem solving conversations. Why would they? You're just going to make them feel bad. Like that's your strategy. Mm-hmm. And it can be really hard to overcome. I actually would like to talk a little bit more about, like, that, you know, that shame cycle, because I even, like I say, we live in a culture of shame, and sometimes that's my automatic thing to do, to shame. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I've gotten a way better at, you know, not shaming children, but like even for like other relationships that I have, you know, that's will sometimes shame and even jokingly, but it's the default thing. And so like how, you know, do you have any, you know, thoughts specifically on just on maybe even undoing shame within ourselves and healing that part of ourselves so that we don't project and pass on the shame cycle to our children?
Yeah, I like what Tiffany said, because I have several colleagues who are Latina and Latinx, and they talk about the chancla culture, right? And it's that flip-flop beats you over the head and then you don't feel bad about it. And if I can punish you and make you feel bad enough, then you won't repeat it. And I was like, no, actually what they do is they get better at hiding and lying. That's what they do. And then feeling like you said, Chaz, like that your child then can't go to you because you're so busy shaming them and making them feel bad about their mistake that they don't feel like they can actually make a mistake because you're going to get into this beating them down with your words or your hands, so that they then learn to go somewhere else to deal with that. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a couple things. One is that I think as adults, we have to stop justifying those methods as, well, I turned out fine, so why can't I do it? I'm like, well, did you really? So why are we keep talking about this then? Like if we keep talking about it and you feel like you're not acing parenting and you keep feeling like you're repeating the cycle, did you really turn out okay then? And so I think we have to stop justifying it, because it was really hitting me the other day where I was like, wow, like what else do we say that for? It's like, well, you know, that person was kidnapped and held for 30 days and they're fine. Well, but it doesn't make the kidnapping okay. Like, well, you know, their country was bombed and they're fine. Like we, that doesn't make any sense. Like we need to stop that. Like just because the person appears to be fine, or maybe they are more resilient, or they did the work and they came out okay. There's lots of people who can come out of it, but do we have to go through shame and abuse and oppression just to come out okay? Like, I don't think that should be a foundation as to strength, right? So I think we need to stop that excuse. The other thing is that I think we also as parents need to not take our kids' behaviors so personally. Because I think when kids do things, we think it's a poor reflection on us, which is why a lot of times parents did, you know, whoop them or chancla them or whatever, is that they felt like, you're making me look bad and you're making me look like a bad parent, so I gotta put you in line. And there's colonial ties to that. There's lots of history of colonial ties to that, where, for example, the enslaved would beat, African would beat their child, because then it's better if I beat you than if the slave master then beats you, because then at least I can keep you in line. You don't want to make the plantation look bad. You don't want to make them look bad. You know, there's all these things that are kind of tied to that kind of oppressive culture. And so we often will then attribute our children's behavior, thinking that they're a poor reflection on us. If my kid is acting up, that must mean I'm a bad parent. And I think we have to stop taking our kids' behavior so personally, thinking it's a personal attack on us, and instead realize that kids have free will, and that you could be the best parent ever and your kid could still be having a rough time. Yeah. You could be the worst parent ever and your kid could be great. Yeah. For a time, one of my early training experiences was in Arizona, and I worked with high profile cases of kids who were severely abused. Like, these were kids where I had to stop reading the police reports. That's how bad it was. These are kids who were chained up outside or beaten or incest, all kinds of horrible, horrible stuff. And they were some of the best clients I have ever seen since and before then. And they were so sweet. And that's another thing. Well, they turned out okay. Well, yeah, but do we want them to be turned out okay just because of the situation? And of course, these were kids who came from homes that their parents made really bad, straight up bad choices. And yet they had these beautiful kids who rose out of these ashes so wonderfully, right? And so we can't equate parenting with the way our kids turn out every single time. Yes, can that affect them? Totally, yes. But there are times when you could be doing everything right and your kid still makes bad choices. And so I think we have to make sure that we don't take our kids' behaviors so personally that that's when we will tend to overreact when they mess up. So they sass us or they say something rude to the teacher and we're like, I can't believe you would do that. So then we have this huge punishment because how dare you act like this when I raised you better than that? And so I think we have to be aware that it's just because it was done to us doesn't make it okay. And that we can't take this behavior so personally because we have to break these cycles so that we're not keep repeating the same things that we got.
And you said something I think is like, that is like a shame red flag that I think, you know, when I raised you better and you're making the behavior about you and you think that it's a reflection on you. And, you know, I think that is kind of, that's a red flag right there. So if you're someone out there who's listening and you're using it, like, I think you, it's really worth it to kind of do that internal work and just rethink, well, why, you know, why am I putting it on me? Like, was I shamed as a child? And am I fearing that shame from others in my environment? And now again, creating that cycle and putting it on my child. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I remember too, Chaz, I was an adult, I was married and before I had kids and I went home to visit my mom and I grew up on an island. And so I had come home and I hadn't had island food for a long time. It was for my birthday. And she asked me, she says, how do you want to celebrate your birthday? And I said, I would love to have like a spread of all of my favorite island food with all the people that I really love. And, you know, I haven't seen in a long time. And so But I said, I just want it small and intimate. And she went like overboard. Like she went way above and beyond that I even asked for. And so she had all this food and all these people and everything. And I remember before the party even started, she was like, I hope you're grateful for everything I did. And I was like, I didn't even ask for all this. You know? And so it was one of those things where, and it's not something where she was in the habit of shaming. But it was these little comments that I think we make as parents sometimes that we don't even realize we're making. And I mean, that was like years ago and that has still stuck with me, right? So then every time that I ask for something, I'm always aware, okay, am I asking for too much? And so then I think that those kinds of things, when it sticks with us, then we're like, okay, so then when I'm parenting my own kid or in my business or in interactions with other people, am I being too much or am I asking for too much? And that's how cycles continue, is even those little comments like that, how it sticks with you, and then it becomes a narrative that you play in your head. Oh, am I being too much or am I being grateful? Or how am I being perceived in this situation? And then it's like, it's amazing then that seed gets planted. And then you're like, dang it, now I gotta break this.
Yeah. And you know, I wonder, you know, from our conversation before we started recording, I wonder if that came from a place from your mom of just maybe when she grew up, like she maybe didn't have like the big extravagant things and she always wanted it. And so she was trying to be the mom that she never had instead of, you know, being, you know, the mom that you needed in that moment or whatever. She was trying to, you know, relive the past. Now, we haven't talked about that on the air, but could you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, one of the things that we were talking about is this concept, I believe it was Freud that talked about it, about this repetition compulsion. I don't know if it was him or not, but it's this idea in psychology, this repetition compulsion, where we feel compelled to repeat cycles to correct the things from our past. And so why someone, as say a woman who had a dad who was absent, which is my story, my dad and my mom divorced when I was 3. So and he was like emotionally and physically absent. Okay. Deadbeat dad. Okay. And everybody that I dated, literally every dude I dated, my mom did not like. Just the same kind of personality, same kind of not being emotionally present and available. And I knew it going in. Like it was red flags waving everywhere. And I was like, this is the one. And but when I met my husband, he was completely different from the rest, completely different. And we weren't even dating when we got engaged. And my mom had met him the night before we got engaged. And she instantly liked him. She was even like, so when is the when's the wedding going to be? It's going to be this year. We had literally known each other 2 months and got engaged. That's never how I operated, ever. And she instantly loved him. And actually, he is more like my mom, which is who I needed to marry, not my dad. Because I dated my dad and married my mom, which is so weird in and of itself. But anyway, so the whole thing is that, but for me, when I was doing kind of my own work, my thing is, well, I am going to get this mess of a man because I'm going to make him a better person, kind of like what I wish my mom would have done to my dad. And so then I would have these like buster of these dudes, terrible. And then we would break up and then they would date the next person and be like the catch. And I was like, great. So I'm preparing them for another relationship, but you're dogging me out while we're dating. And so it was that whole, but that's that compulsion. It's that I'm going to fix you and I'm going to make this better because this is what I should have had. This is what my mom should have done and that she couldn't do and wasn't able to do. My dad didn't allow her to do whatever it is. And, but the thing is, that's not going to work because I'm not my mom and that's not my dad. And so this compulsion that we get to relive the things from our past is the very thing that keeps us stuck in the cycle because we're trying to be, we're in the wrong shoes. I'm not my mom. And these people are not my dad to fix. And nothing I do, I can get the worst person and nothing I do is ever going to change that relationship because it's already in the past. I have to be the person I need to be and I need to heal myself knowing that I am worthy. Because when I did meet my husband, who was amazing, and he was being so sweet to me, and I was like, whatever, don't call me. And he was like, okay. And I was like, what? You're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to stalk me, call me. And, you know, and he was like, I'm not about that life. And I was like, but you're like, I was used to the drama.
Yeah.
And he was not at all like that. So when I realized, oh, there are good guys out there, then I was able to kind of come correct and then be able to then connect with him and then heal. A lot of my healing came because I realized I was worthy of being with someone who valued me and that I could value myself. So I was a mess when we first met, like a mess. And it was a lot of through being accepted for who I was how I was able to break a lot of those cycles. But it was a lot of work and it was painful. And, but it was a lot of that. I am worthy and I do deserve to be with someone who cares about me and who actually has my back. And I do. And even like when we would get upset, I would get upset with him and then we would be like making up the bed and I'd be like, be silent. He's like, why are we like hanging out and not talking to each other? This is ridiculous. And I was like, yeah, you're right. Cause that's the thing that you learn. You mad at me. I'm mad at you. So I'm not going to talk to you. And he's like, that's ridiculous. Like, how old are we? Right. But we will keep repeating those cycles if we're not aware of them. And we will just keep. That's why people go from one relationship to the next. And it's just as bad as the other one. Why people in multiple marriages keep marrying down every time. Because if you haven't healed, then you're going to keep getting the wrong person for you. And you're going to keep being wounded because you haven't healed yourself.
So so you mentioned earlier, well, you mentioned a lot of things earlier, but you were talking about like some of the history of how a lot of this stuff goes way back to colonial times. And I would imagine even before then too. And you were talking about like, at some point it was, it did serve, you know, like as, you know, a person of color, as a slave during slave times. It makes sense that like, yes, I do need them to be the number one thing that I need them to be is obedient so that they live and they can make it off this plantation. And maybe at some point, yeah. So that was serving African Americans at that time, but it still, when it no longer serves us, it's still a part of us. Right. It's not. And the same thing, you know, even in our childhood, you know, things that we do to protect ourselves in our childhood, like, you know, maybe we'll be very quiet and we're silent or we'll hide parts of ourselves. And that serves us as a child because the way that we're responded to when we do speak up. And but I wonder, or I guess I'm asking, I maybe talk about a little like, is there a biological component to this, right? How does this affect our you know, how does this affect our genes? Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it has so many layers to it because I see it beyond just biological. I think it's more of an epigenetic component. And the epigenetics is, we know that genes is how our phenotypes and genotype gets expressed. So how our skin color, our eye color, our personality, all of that stuff is our genetic material. And then there's the epigenetic material, and that is the material that sits on top of the gene, epi meaning on top of the gene, and that turns it on or off. So there are certain things in our history, typically sociological, racial history, that will turn on or off those genes. And there are 10 epigenetic factors, or ACEs rather, adverse childhood experiences that serve as the epigenetic trauma that can turn on and off those genes. And so there's lots of research that talks about if you have 4 out of the 10 ACEs, then you're more at risk for a lot of biological, medical, psychological, sociological factors. So these are things like physical, sexual, emotional abuse and neglect, alcoholism, substance abuse, homelessness, mental illness of a primary caregiver. So there's 10 different things. And if we have 4 or more, we're more at risk of early death by 20 years, developing Alzheimer's, cholesterol, high blood pressure, repeating the cycle ourselves. And so when we have these genes that we carry, the problem with that is that when we have our offspring, we pass that on to them. So then they're born at a disadvantage. So if you've been abused, homelessness, and had a parent with a mental illness and alcoholism, now you got 4 of the adverse childhood experiences. When you have a child, your child now inherits some of those epigenetic materials because you've turned on, you've altered your genetic material. So when we talk about passing on cycles and generational cycles, oh, we have a family history of alcoholism. Well, there's no alcohol gene in our genome, but there's epigenetics of alcoholism. And so those things, then yeah, that's how you could have a family history of alcoholism or obesity or drug abuse or sexual abuse, is that that's how those things get passed on because that gene has now been turned on. And if you didn't deal with your stuff, now you give birth to a child who now has a risk factor that's higher than what yours was. And that's why we have to be aware of that, because if we don't, we're continuing the cycles that we think we're stopping when we actually aren't.
So even if, so let's say we experience this trauma, we have the 4, maybe we have 5, you know, ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, you know, and so let's say we're doing the work, we're going to therapy, we're, you know, listening to the podcast, we're doing the journaling, we're doing the breathing work, we're checking in with our body. Does it still get passed on? Does it still get passed on to our children if we do the healing work?
Right. Great question. No. So the bad news is that you have it and you can pass it on. The good news is that there's protective factors that can reverse it. And so the things that reverse it are being able to do all the things that you mentioned, doing your own reparenting, doing your own work, getting your own therapy, having support groups, having a trusted other. One of the things that I learned early on in my training, like when I worked with kids who were abused, who had tons of adverse childhood experiences, is there's 3 things that determine whether or not these kids heal. Because there are kids that I saw with severe presentations and they thrived, because if you're able to tell, you're believed and you get help, if those factors are in place, your prognosis is so much better than people who suffer in silence or aren't believed or are denied or don't get help. And so, yes, seeking out help and getting help, getting support, journaling, breath work, yoga, exercise, having supportive people, healthy individuals in your life, all of those things can be corrective emotional experiences. And those corrective emotional experiences can reverse the effects of ACEs. So even the stuff that I mentioned earlier. I come from a divorce home. There's abuse in my life. There's trauma in terms of historical trauma, racial trauma, natural disaster trauma. I was inside of my house when I got hit by a hurricane and it ripped it apart, homeless for 9 months. I mean, lots of trauma in my background, right? And, but there's a lot of things that I've done where I don't present like a traumatized individual, like people, what people might think. But I've also done a lot of heckin' work. And yeah. Does it mean that I'm totally immune to it? No, there are times when I'm still triggered by certain things or think parts of parenting that may have triggered some old stuff. But that's the whole point, is being able to do the work and get through it. So that way you can be able to heal. So yeah, it is possible to go through all this crap and feel like you could be a statistic, but that if you do the work, a lot of that stuff can be reversed, not necessarily reversed, that's a wrong word, but you can be able to kind of get through it and heal and kind of rise out of it. I kind of, the image that I get is kind of like the phoenix, like you're burnt, maybe to a crisp even, and then be able to then rise out of it and actually be more beautiful and be changed. And so I remember when I worked at the military hospital, I worked on the burn unit for a while. I couldn't continue that work, but a lot of the individuals that I would see would be severely burned and they go through a process. And then when they would get out on the other side, or even cancer patients with chemo, they would get these radiation burns or lose their hair. And but then when they would heal and finish the treatment, their skin would be brighter and more radiant afterwards, for example, or their hair would have fallen out, but come back like a brighter color or curly or some other texture. And it was that kind of image for me that's like, yeah, you had this loss, but you came out on the other side different and changed. And maybe you can't go back to who you were, but you're now a new kind of version of yourself.
Yeah. Wow. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. And you know, my vision really for the world and what I'm trying to accomplish with the podcast, with the social media, with the Patreon, with really everything that I'm trying to do is I want to help adults see God and build with children to really help children feel seen. And it's really powerful that you said, like, the, you know, a child being able to tell a story and believed and helped. You know, those are the two, you know, the first two parts, is to really truly see them and to guide them and also build trust with them and you know, build, you know, relationship, build skills. And that's kind of what I'm hearing, is that that's also a way, not just a way to, you know, have a great relationship with your child throughout life and to help them with their challenges, but also to help buffer the effects of trauma and generational trauma that we may not even be super aware of, because maybe we thought we did all the work, but it's still, or maybe we did the work, we were still doing the work when we were having, you know, children. And so like they still have it in their genes. And so now it's being expressed, and you know, we're working through that with them. We're seeing them. We're guiding them. We're building skills around it. And so that's really beautiful to hear.
All right. Yeah, parenting is hard work.
Yeah. And you know, so there's also something that I've noticed too. So a lot of the cycles that we, you know, the cycles live in us, and it shows up. I notice it doesn't just show up in parenting, but also shows up in at your workplace. It also shows up at, you know, I know for sure it shows up in teachers who are working with children. So it's not even just, you know, your own children. I see that shame cycle being perpetuated. I see, and it's, you know, again, it's the way they were raised. It's the culture. When I think it's the culture that we've all been raised in, kind of in a shame culture, and it's just being perpetuated. And so, you know, I think that the work is, it can almost feel or seem overwhelming, because You also have to think, even you as a parent, so you do the work and you have, you know, you've done the work. You're no longer shaming your child. You're being empathetic. You're seeing them. You're guiding them. You're building with them. But then they go to school and they have teachers who might be shame and humiliation might be their way of trying to get a child to do X, Y, and Z. And now that's something that's another weight on top of the cycle that you're already trying to break. But again, like you said, the good news in it is that you as the parent can still buffer that by hearing them and seeing them and guiding them and helping them work through that. So that almost, I think that answers actually the last question that I had of like, how do you break?
Can I mention one thing about what you said? I remember a couple of years ago, I was doing a presentation to a group of teachers. It was in person and it was a group of teachers. And I was talking about ADHD and talking about making reasonable accommodations in the classroom for children who had ADHD, learning disabilities, that kind of stuff. And I had this one particular teacher in there who started copping an attitude with her questions. Like, so I talked about like, you know, you can untime tests or extra time for tests or reduce homework. And she was like, but why should we do that? And I was like, I was explaining because of executive functioning, we're trying to build skills and we can kind of build up to the homework load. But for now it's harder for them and it's overwhelming and blah, blah. And she just kept like grilling me and it was really borderline disrespectful. And I was like, and people were like looking at her as like, dude. And so she was being very like attacking. It was just really, it was very hostile. And I was like, what is up with this? Like, I am just talking about making reasonable accommodations. Why is she being so hostile about this? So she came up to me at the break and she was like, I had an aha moment while you were talking and I wanted to apologize for how I was coming across. And I said, okay, what's going on? And she says, I realized that as you were talking that I had a lot of those symptoms that you were describing and I didn't really realize how much I struggled in school to that extent. But I also realized that teachers and weren't willing to provide any help or assistance for me. And so when you were talking about making these accommodations for students, I was like, well, nobody did that for me. And so I was talking from a place of really seeing it from being offended, because why should I help anybody else when nobody helped me? And I, you know, I accepted her apology and I said, you know, I get it, is that these things can be very triggering for us when we hear these things, because they are the right thing to do. But back when you were a kid, they didn't know any better. They didn't know that that's what you're supposed to do. You're just supposed to just suck it up and be able to just learn. And so I think we have to realize that as teachers, as parents, as professionals, we can be triggered by a lot of these things that our kids do that we're teaching or raising and then connecting with, and that we have to realize that if we don't realize that when we're being triggered by something, we're just perpetuating that same experience. So we have to provide that corrective experience for that kid, because otherwise, you know, we're just doing the same thing to them that the person did to us. And they're like, well, we're not any better and we know better. So I just really remember that. That always stood out to me. And I think that's important for us to remember that.
Yeah. That was a very powerful story. That same, I hear and see that same attitude kind of all the time. Those feelings of, oh, I didn't get it. You know, this isn't the way that I grew up. This is not what I came to expect or had growing up. So like, why should they?
Right.
And that's, again, that is just, we feel compelled to perpetuate the cycle. And it's so important to just be aware. So I love that. I love that. So I'm going to ask you, I feel like we kind of answered the question, but I'm going to ask it to you point blank and let you just answer. So we talked about the cycle and, you know, how it happens, how it continues, how it perpetuates itself, but how do we break it?
Great question. I think we break it a few ways. One is by being aware that we're even doing it to begin with, right? Is that healing has to first come through awareness. So we have to be aware, just like this woman, this aha moment, just like me with the way, you know, with my husband and when I first met him, like we have to have this awareness that we're even doing it to begin with. Cause if not, we're just going to go into a trance state and being an habitual state and we just keep repeating it. So the awareness has to be first. And then having the insight and making connections between, oh, when I feel this, I tend to do this. When I get triggered by this, I tend to think this. That I think we have to have that insight and make those connections so that we could start pruning those connections. We have to actually, because our brain is now wired for that. And we have to then start pruning, okay, people aren't going to always put me on the carpet and say I have to be grateful. People aren't always going to take advantage of me. People aren't always thinking that they're better than me. People, whatever it is that, you know, people aren't always going to shame me. I'm not always going to be incompetent. I'm not always having to feel this. And so we have to have that insight and then start to prune that, those connections so that we can make new connections. So that like, okay, when I'm angry at my spouse, I don't need to give the silent treatment. What I need to do is talk about the problem. So now I prune the silent treatment and the shutting down, which is what I did, you know, growing up and what I did with him in the beginning. And now I make this new connection where, okay, no, we talk about things that are problems. Oh, wow. That's brand new information. We actually talk about our feelings and our problems. Okay. Got it. So then when we do that, then we have to start practicing that new behavior. And then every time we feel drawn into that old habit, like, nope, we got to be intentional. That's why that awareness of insight and pruning is so important. So that way we can say, okay, now, oh, okay, that's a habit. I will be drawn into the old ways of being, but I need to be intentional in doing something different. And it's going to feel awkward and weird and uncomfortable, but I can build my tolerance for distress and my tolerance for feeling uncomfortable or worried or anxious or overwhelmed. And then I can get mastery. So on the fly, that's what I'm thinking is that awareness, the insight, the pruning, and then being able to then have that change behavior. Because you can have all the awareness and insight you want, but if you don't do anything differently, then you just have awareness and insight. So you got to have to, you have to actually start doing something differently.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's where a lot of people, you know, at least a lot of people that I talk to have the hang up, because usually by the time that message me or we're talking, you know, we're talking because, okay, maybe I saw a video, I have the awareness, but now my automatic responses are still happening. Like, I can't stop the shame from coming out of my mouth. Like, I feel compelled to do the, you know, whatever cycles that I'm trying to break. So do you have any strategies to help people kind of move from the awareness to more concretely to the practice and to be more consistent with the practice?
I think a lot of it goes back to your self-talk. And that's why I'm really big on like self-scripts, because our behavior is tied to our thoughts and our thoughts are tied to our language. So really for me, the most concrete way to look at it is you have to monitor the way you talk to yourself. Because for most people, the shame cycle is actually not occurring by anybody else but you. Like that message that you got 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago is not actually being told to you anymore in many instances. It's an old wound that you are repeating to yourself, right? So that's why I believe that that self-script needs to be the thing that you say to yourself, because then as you can start to use different language, because like I tell my clients all the time, you talk to yourself more than anybody else. So your messages have to be the thing that is healthy. Because if you're constantly saying negative things to yourself and you're giving yourself shame messages, oh, I should have known better. Why did I do that? I can't believe I yelled at my kid again. I should know better. Oh my gosh, what it, and you keep saying these things to yourself. Of course, you're going to feel like a terrible parent and you're going to keep doing terrible parent things, because only terrible parents yell at their kids, because that's the message you keep telling yourself. Well, no, I yelled at my kid this weekend and I know better, right? Yeah. So the thing is that we know a lot of things that we should do, and yet we still do it. And so we mess up. So I say, yes, of course I yelled. I was frustrated and I felt that he was being ungrateful, because that's a trigger for me, right?
Full circle. I love it.
Full circle. But I was like, no, it's not about me. He doesn't want our weekend to end because we went down to the beach and it was our first trip in like over a year. So he didn't want it to end because he's like finally at the house and he's like, we never do anything. And I was like, this fool just said we never do nothing. So then I started to yell and I was like, are you kidding me? We never do anything, didn't we? And I started laying and I was like, okay. You're really disappointed that it has to end because it's our first time being out of the house. I totally get it. I wish it didn't end either. And I caught myself after I yelled.
I love it. I love
it. So I said that self-script, that self-talk is super important because nothing will change if you don't stop talking to yourself in a shameful way.
But now I'm curious, like, how did he respond after, you know, you did the yelling, but then you like, you breathe, you said, and then you were validating his feelings. How did he respond?
And I wasn't like yelling, but I was talking in a very stern voice. So when I first started talking, I saw him shut down. And then I was like, sweetheart, I know that you're disappointed. And he's like, I am. And I was like, I know. Because you wish that it would never end and you're not looking forward to going back home because you really enjoy the time we spent together. And then I could just see him light up because he felt seen, because that was the real issue. It wasn't that he was ungrateful. It was that he didn't want it to end. Like, this was amazing. We actually got out of the house. We're in the elements. We're on the beach. We had all these firsts and it was amazing. And he didn't want it to end. That was the real issue. So when I was able to actually address what the real issue was, then it was able to just, you could feel like it felt better for me and for him. Yeah. That was the issue. Not that he was being ungrateful.
I love it. Tell the people about plug any of your stuff, where they can find you.
Yes. Go for it. All right. So you can find me online. My website is anewdaysa.com. That's my practice. So anewdaysa is in sanantonio.com. I have tons of resources. If you feel like you're ready to do the work and do some parent coaching, I do virtual parent coaching right now to help parents. So that's available to you. You can also find me on Instagram. I'm really active there at Dr. Ann Louise Lockhart. So dr.annlouise.lockhart. And then also on Facebook at A New Day Pediatric Psychology. So all there, those places I have resources, I have things you can download. And then I also have courses on my website that you can get for parents of kids who are highly sensitive, anxious kids, kids with ADHD, or if you're an adult yourself with executive functioning challenges or ADHD, I have a course for adults as well too. So.
Love it. All right. Stop the broadcast. Yes.
What's my name? What's my name? What's